I want to talk to you today because this is going to be kind of fun. I've had this on my mind to do for a long time. And I wanted to talk to you about the book that is probably the single most controversial, certainly the most misunderstood, misread, or least understood letter in the Bible. Somebody shut that kid up, please. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, she's getting trapped. No, that's Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. She owns my heart. No, I preach right through that. And if you're a guest, I'm just joking. We love the kids here. I love it. So anyway, so this book, they call it a book, but it's just a letter. It's called Revelation, okay? Not Revelations, as a lot of people like to add an S. It's Revelation. And I taught a whole series for many months on the Wednesday night group years ago. And it was fascinating to do that, kind of going verse by verse. But the truth is, I also felt like, man, this is a colossal waste of time, too, to get to the punchline. I thought about doing a series in here, and I thought, yeah, a series is just too much. But I will, so I'm just going to do this one teaching on the book of Revelation, and then you guys can do what you want with it, and I'll have it on record. And everybody, if anybody ever asks me, so what do you think about Revelation, I can say, you know, listen to the podcast. And it's going to be a one-and-done revelation. The word revelation is the English translation of the name of the book, which is apocalypse in the Greek. Now we think of like the apocalypse is coming, right? That's become synonymous more with the depictions in the book than what the actual word apocalypse means. Apocalypse doesn't mean anything terrible. Apocalypse simply means in Greek revelation, a revelation, a showing. Something's going to be revealed, okay? So that's what it means. But it is a book, especially in current times, in my whole life. I grew up not going to church, but my dad would watch some TV preachers and stuff on TV once in a while. And way back then, they had this guy that was a famous apocalyptic, sermon prophet guy. His name was Robert Lindsay. And he wrote this book, The Late Great Planet Earth. I'm talking like 50 years ago. And it was all, my dad loved that stuff because it was all about like how the world is going to end at any minute. And back then it was, Khrushchev. And there's always, because you have in this book, you have what many people call the Antichrist. Although the word Antichrist does not show up in the book of Revelation at all. It shows up in some epistles of another writer. But it has monsters in it. It has a dragon and a red dragon and a monster that comes from the sea and a monster from the land. And it's like a really bad acid trip. Not that I've ever been on acid much, but it's got like 10-headed dragons and it's got all kinds of crazy images. It really looks like just this wild, wild story. It's filled with symbols. And because it's filled with symbols, you can pretty much do what you want with it, and people have for a couple of thousand years. I say that I want to give a little bit of background to this book. And I'll give away the punchline. While everybody looks at that book and Revelation, and they do this end times thing with it, like again, Lindsay, I mean, through the years, the people that have gotten the title as Antichrist. The list is, 9 feet long. Any contemporary person in time, it seems like somebody gets it, right? I remember when it was like Gorbachev, right? I mean, a lot of people were saying Gorbachev was the Antichrist, and he had the stain on his forehead, and that was the mark of the beast, I mean, this is the kind of stuff. And people would spend conferences with curtains from that end to this end with all kinds of depictions and explanations from the pastor of how this thing is going down now, and Gog and Magog, and this is what's happening now, and this is the Soviet Union. At first, it was the Soviet Union. That was the whore of Babylon. Of course, the Soviet Union fell apart, so then the theory changed, and so did the demagogue. The Pope is a popular target, especially from Protestants. Like, oh, that's the Church of Rome, whore of Babylon. Because there's this whore that comes out on one of the dragons, or one of the monsters, and speaks blasphemies and persecutes the Christian communities. So you get all these images. I mean, like, even now, and which is one of the fun reasons to bring it up, because I've already heard it so many times. Oh, my God. Well, I heard it 8 years ago. Obama's the Antichrist. Obama is the Antichrist. One world order. You know, then, but that's on the heels of Bush, because while Bush was popular in America, it, Christians across the world who were watching what America was doing, invading Iraq and doing all those things, other Christians were saying Bush is the Antichrist. That was a very popular statement back there. Don't nod. I'm just saying. Bush was the Antichrist. No, and so, and now, oh my God, between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, that label is being thrown out. Oh my God. It's the apocalypse. It's the end of the world. This is the Antichrist. It's all this stuff. And they always cite the book of Revelation. Okay. Here's what I want to say to catch you, shock you, and suck you in, and then I got to explain myself. This is my opinion. It's a scholarly opinion. This is not something I'm pulling out of thin air, okay? The real Antichrist in the book of Revelation is the author John himself. What? Now, before you run out of here saying, Pastor Paul Bergman just said that the Apostle John is the Antichrist, let me explain myself. The word Antichrist is loosely used in the scriptures to mean anybody that's opposing the teachings of Christ. And I would submit to you that you're going to understand pretty quickly that much of what is in this book is diametrically opposed to the teaching of Christ. When we say the Apostle John wrote the book, first of all, myth. No way, no how. Somebody named John wrote the book, who was definitely some sort of prophet in his own eyes and the eyes of some other Christians. This is about 90 AD, we date the book, 90 AD. That period of Christian development, and I mean development, was still very new and fresh. There were many different assorted views of what Christianity was and how it was practiced in that first century. Lots of different varieties of Christians. This is not an information age. You didn't pick up your cell phone, you didn't carry around your Bible, and you didn't go to seminary. It was very confusing and very diverse to what was Christianity and what was it not. Depending upon where you lived, where you grew up with, and who you encountered, or what particular letter or piece of what we now call scripture was read to you or that you heard. It was very different and in flux. It was still gelling. The writer is John, but not John the apostle, not John the disciple. And this is a funny thing, because unless you actually do textual criticism, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. You know, and one of the reasons they gave that attribution to the Apostle John was what was a typical thing done in the first century during the time of development of Scripture. You wanted your letter to bear some weight. You wanted it to be important to people. So you would give it a name, a pseudonym, and then you would say, oh, look, this is the Apocalypse of Peter, because Peter wrote it. But Peter did not write the Apocalypse of Peter. We know that now. You do that because you want audiences to read it. This was a popular book. Why? Because it is hellfire and brimstone. It is why churches fill up in the South to hear the fat, bloated preacher wagging his finger talking about the end of the world and how the Sodomites are going to go to hell and how you're going to hell and they're going to hell. Everybody's going to hell, but we're going to heaven. It is filled with that kind of stuff that people are drawn to. It's a bit macabre. It's kind of like, you know, it's like, you know, the Saw movies. Saw 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. People like, oh, they loved the horror of it. So they were drawn to this book. And the writing style is very different. It's definitely not John's. And this is what, when people write things, you know, oh, John wrote this book and it's a book of John. You realize that until you actually know the languages, read the languages fluently, you can't understand the differences that make it very clear that this is one author and this is the other. This was written at this time and this is written at another. If you read a letter and it was in the thee, thou, thou, thouest, doest of the old King James, you'd know, well, that must have come from the 17th century. If it was like, yo, man, that was so awesome last night. The dude was totally shredding. You'd go like, probably not 17th century. And yet when you read these things in the actual languages, you see those distinct differences, and then you translate them still into the vernacular of today, into the current idioms that we have today. So this letter was not written. It was written by the apostle. It was written by a guy named John. Now, the interesting thing about this, and this is very different about what we call apocalyptic literature. There is a specific genre that we write, that the writers would write with strong imagery and very provocative things. It was very theologically and politically subversive, very subversive. And usually, it was a pseudonym. It was a pseudonym. They would use a pseudo name, somebody else's name. First of all, because you wanted the weight to be behind it, like this was written by Matthew. Oh, yeah. But then there was also the insulation, like if it doesn't go well, nobody's going to identify me as the author, okay? Then I'm going to stay out of trouble. So that's one of the reasons they did it. Interesting about this letter, though, is that scholars believe that the actual person who wrote this is the actual name, John. So it's a little bit different in apocalyptic literature. This was a guy named John, and he wrote it from an island called Patmos in the Med. It was a prison camp, so to speak, a Roman one. And he is in exile on this prison camp, and he writes this letter. Now, why is he in a prison, in a Roman prison camp? Well, already we would see because of the letter, it would tell us something. He is a political activist. And he is subversive in his teachings. He does not like Rome. Why? Because one thing we know about Yohanan, his name, a very common Jewish name, Yohanan, is he's a Jew. He is a devout Jew. He's not even a Christian. He is a Jewish follower of Yeshua, of Jesus. Okay? And he has witnessed something horrific. People think this book is about the end of the world. No. John wrote this because, in his view, the world was ending and had ended. His community of faith, the center of his religion and his God, Israel, and specifically Judaism, as represented in the temple in Jerusalem. Jerusalem had just been destroyed. In 66 AD, Zealots, a different branch of Judaism, revolted, much the way they expected and wanted Jesus to do, but he didn't. He preached a different message of loving your neighbor, loving your enemy even, praying for them, overcoming evil with good. That didn't go so well with the patriots, with the Zealots. They wanted a fight. They were hoping Jesus would lead them in a fight. So they got into a fight in 66 AD, and by 70 AD, Israel basically ceased to exist. The Roman legions came in and leveled Israel, and leveled specifically Jerusalem, and leveled the most beloved center and heart of their faith, the temple. Literally, as Jesus had said, not one stone was left on another. And if you go to Israel today, and you visit Jerusalem, and you go to the Temple Mount, and you look, you will see these gigantic stones, just monstrous stones like trucks, just tumbled. They literally pushed every rock off and destroyed the thing. He witnessed that. They murdered, estimated, around 1 million Jews, the Romans did, in the siege. People were it was a slaughter like no other. His world was collapsing around him. And Rome was the culprit. And he was anti-Rome. And he is pissed off. He is an angry, angry, wounded man. And he is a fire and brimstone preacher. But does he know what he's preaching about? Truth is, very little. There's very little evidence at all that the author of this letter understands or knows Jesus or heard Jesus' teachings at all. In fact, most scholars would tell you he probably never read a gospel. He certainly never read some of the foundational and seminal teachings of Jesus as exampled in the Sermon on the Mount. No way, no how did this guy ever hear Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So he's writing from a very limited perspective as a very devout Jew. And he writes this letter that opens up with him slashing and smashing and trashing seven churches in Asia Minor, which is now basically Turkey. He rips them a new one, most of them. And then he shifts to the current affairs. So here's the key. It's very simple to Revelation. Everything in the book is written from the perspective of a current affair. These things weren't going to happen in some future end of the world. They were happening now. Now, he used subversive language. He used coded language. He wrote in coded language. He used symbols in imagery. There's a big red dragon that comes out that's identified in the letter itself as Satan, the one that is behind the energies of these other two monsters that come from the land and sea. One of those monsters is the Whore of Babylon. And this Whore of Babylon begins this persecution that's ongoing, because in fact, Christians were being persecuted mightily in that first century as an atheist sect, which is kind of funny. You think, atheists? Yeah. They only believed in one God, and Jesus was the personification, and they're like, you know, you can believe in Jesus, but you got to believe in all the other thousands of gods, you know, because that's how we are. And so if you only believe in one God, you were considered an atheist. And a threat, because they said, which is Christianity is a subversive religion, they didn't say what was the common phrase of the day, Caesar is Lord, Kaiser ho kurios. They would say, Jesus is Lord. Whoa! That's not patriotic. You're not buying into the program. So they were persecuted. The second beast that came out was a beast that deified itself and had the people worship it. And then he gave each person who would worship it a mark. 666. Come on, have you seen the omen? Come on, it's the 666. I mean, I've literally seen politicians' heads being analyzed, like, look, I think I see a scar, and it looks like a 666. Literally, like, this is going on, right? And this is the mark of the beast. And this mark allows you, from a imperial point of view, to do transactions, business within the empire and kingdom. If you have this mark, you're good to go. That's why you see people freaking out like, oh my God. You know, this is years ago, you know, when they started making the Social Security system in America. Okay, you got to have a number. It's the freaking mark of the beast, you know. And then they came out with, you know, barcodes. Dude, it's the mark of the beast. We're all going to have barcodes on our forehead. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that goes on. And it's very, ooh, fascinating and inflaming. But the point of the first beast, of the first beast, the Whore of Babylon, it was absolutely clearly Rome to the first century readers. They all knew that. It was Rome. It was Rome that was killing all of the Christians. And in one portion in the book, they are killing so many, their souls are up in heaven with God, appealing to him like, when are you going to avenge us? It's a book about vengeance, big time. And divine justice. I want to just put it all down. These are people who have been violated horrifically, like the Holocaust, and they're calling out to their God, give us some justice. When are you going to rain hell and fire and brimstone on them, right? And then that happens in the book. And in the simplest understanding of the story, it is about good versus evil. It's about losers getting a letter. Think of Churchill during World War II, under the enormous bombing of his country, who would get on the airwaves and say, never, never, never. So this is kind of that guy. He's a pissed off guy who's on the losing end, and he is crying out for justice to his God. And he is saying, you may be wiping us out now, but in the end, we win. I understand that theme. It makes perfect sense to me. Is it a Jesus-like theme? No, it's actually the antithesis of Jesus' teaching, in fact, of how to live in the world. And yet he's a very frustrated, under pressure, persecuted person. And I get that. He's mad and he's angry and he's on a rant, and I get that. But if you really want to simply understand the book, it just basically says, we win in the end. We're getting hammered, but we win in the end. Because Jesus is coming back, and he comes back like in a form like nobody would recognize. He comes back with a sword, and he rides a stallion, and he starts hacking into the people, and he slaughters them, and there's so much slaughter that the blood piles up and reaches the bridle of the horse he's riding on. The book is a huge problem for Jesus followers, depending on what kind of Jesus follower you want to be. Now imagine Gandhi is resurrected. I am back. And now I'd like to lead you in a revolution of blood. Everyone grab a weapon and begin to slaughter the British. No, it doesn't make sense. It's like MLK coming from the grave. I'm back. Malcolm was right. Any means necessary. Lock and load. Let's fight these whitey devils. Okay? There is nothing Jesus-like at all in the interpretation of this man's vision and purpose. And yet, you can understand why the book is popular. Because guess what? In Christianity today, Sermon on the Mount Jesuses are not popular. Freaking lock and load Jesuses. Let's make the blood run thick in the streets. That is the prevailing theology of many Jesus followers today, and it all falls on this one horrific, misunderstood book. It doesn't mean the book's not valuable or interesting. It is. From a historical perspective, it tells us so much what Christianity was like in the first century, in one of the diverse slices of it. It's very, very telling. Okay, so let me go on a little bit about John. He's an angry Jew. We know that. He's writing in coded language, right? We understand that. If it doesn't make sense to you when you read it, it's because you weren't living in the first century. And he's writing in coded language because, like whatever he said before, he's got his butt thrown into a Roman prison for subversion. He doesn't like that. The interesting things about the beasts that you can easily get is you got one that's the Satan, the dragon. They use even that form because the original Hebrew is the word dragon for the serpent. A dragon came out. We talked about that before. Have you been here before? It's the word dragon. It was a walking dragon, and then it got cursed by God, and it lost its legs, and now it had to slither, and it became a snake. That's how the transformation takes place in the Garden of Eden. The one monster is Rome, simply. It's crushing people. It's crushing their people. There's martyrs left and right. The other dragon is a dragon of empire and commerce. Why is John angry? I'll tell you why. Because he does not like this Christianity that the Apostle Paul has come up with. He's a Jew's Jew. The Apostle Paul, who wrote most of the theology in the epistles of the back end of the New Testament, was a Pharisaical rabbi who encountered Jesus and had a complete overhaul and renewal of his understanding of God's plans. Okay? And violence certainly wasn't one of them. Martyrdom was. But the biggest thing that Paul did that caused literally churches to split very early on. In Jerusalem, there was a gigantic church split. And what was that split about? Paul said, Gentiles. What's a Gentile? Anybody who's not a Jew, okay? You got Jews and Gentiles. If you're a Jew, you're a Jew. If you're not a Jew, any of you in here are a Gentile. Paul proposed that for peoples to become followers of Jesus, they did not have to convert to Judaism, which many original Jewish, because they were all Jewish followers of Jesus, believed needed to happen. Yeah, you could worship the Messiah. Yeah, you could have salvation. Yeah, you could have all these things. But first, you got to get circumcised. It's all through Paul's epistles. You got to get circumcised, and you got to become a member of the synagogue, and you got to start taking on the Torah law. And Paul comes in, because he was all about that. In fact, remember, Paul was murdering the early Jewish Christians, murdering them. He gets this revelation, and he says, guess what? I understand it now. Anybody can be in, and you don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to follow the Torah. You don't have to read, you know, the Tanakh, what we call the Old Testament every day. You don't have to follow its rules anymore. And this was a freaking atom bomb going off. Some people bought into it. Some didn't. Most in Jerusalem rejected Paul's point of view. Hence, Paul started going out into the diaspora, into the Roman Empire, everywhere but Jerusalem, and began to make converts and started to have fellowships and house meetings that we call churches today. And that's where it took off. The Jewish aspect of followers of Jesus was murdered in the 66 to 70 rebellion. They were smashed. The city was smashed. Those Jews, by and large, just were murdered. They died off. John's one of them, and he wasn't murdered. So he comes to Asia Minor, and he starts to rip the churches there. Because guess what? They look too much like us today. They're wearing two-piece bathing suits. I saw him, and he went into an R-rated movie. One of the big things back in those days was the fact that you had to pay tribute to Caesar. You had to live in a place where you were surrounded by Roman idols. But here's the fun thing. Paul was okay with that. Sheesh. Paul even said one time to Christian communities there, you can go ahead and eat the food that was sacrificed to idols. It's like it's in his epistles. It's okay. You can do that. You don't have to have a bad conscience. This guy, John, would be like, kill me before I eat food sacrificed to an idol. You are a heretic, an apostate, Paul. He is ranting against these kind of teachings. The Gentiles were like, yeah, we're followers of Jesus. So now we live in the Roman world and we're doing the best we can with it. No! Stand for something or fall for anything. Withdraw! Retreat! Build your Christian schools. Only have Christian friends. Stay in the Christian church community. Don't go out there. Don't be seen with them. And again, this is why many scholars be like, I don't think this guy has ever read anything about the Gospels of Jesus, because Jesus was always all about out there and assimilating. He was in, but not part of. He accepted everything, but that doesn't mean that he gave thumbs up to everything that was being done. It was a different way of life. John's not having any of it, so he rips them. Early church, women as leaders. John, a good Jew? No freaking way. Matter of fact, he calls one woman leader. He picks on her in one church and calls her a Jezebel. That's like the worst thing you could call him. Another Gentile-heavy church, he says that's a synagogue of Satan. Look at what they're doing over there. Look how they're doing. Ooh, you. And another church, he says, you know what? You aren't sold out. You're lukewarm. And God's going to spit you out of his mouth. You're not cold or hot. You're lukewarm. So he's on a rant. He's angry. And it's understandable from his limited perspective and viewpoint in the world. So what that means in one sense is that what he was also saying is the antichrists were those followers of Jesus that were participating in the system of the empire. You can't do that and be a devout follower of Jesus. You've got to withdraw from that. That's funny, right? Because the irony of ironies today is that teachers and pastors that are preaching the book of Revelation today as a apocalyptic, God's going to kick your butt in the end and we're going to win and the blood's going to flow, they tend to be the ones that are most entwined and in bed with the system today. And they're like, oh, USA, USA. God and country. These tend to be the guys that are like really about like, we need to take over the Senate. We need to take over the... Whereas many people are just like, eh. He's actually saying, no, if you're doing that, you're actually becoming part of the satanic system. We're beyond that. Now, I'm not saying that that's what I believe. It's what he believed. Like, no, you don't touch that. I just think that's ironic that they use this book and are most entwined in that very system because they don't see themselves as actually having the mark of the beast. How Christian is that? It's always everybody else has got the mark of the beast. The mark certainly couldn't be on my head. I'm not culpable. I'm not one that's involved in the system. So he's ranting on them about that. It's not about the end of the world. 666 is not the devil. 666 is coded language. People, if you can figure this out, it was easy to figure out if you were a Jew because you understood gematria as a Jew. What's gematria as a Jew? Jews don't have numbers in their system. They used letters, their alphabetical letters, to represent numbers. So 666 actually represents letters. Those letters in gematria and the value of those letters, I don't want to get too complex, but each letter also has a value that they add to it, adds up to what is spelled out in the original language of the Jewish language, the name Nero. Who was the emperor at the time? Not at this exact time, but he was an emperor at the time of persecution. He was the one that started the famous stories about him lighting followers of Jesus up in his courtyards and eating meals. He was a mass murderer and persecutor of Christians. The economic thing was simply this. You had to pay tribute to Caesar if you wanted to do business. Just like in many ways, if you want to come here, you got to have whatever. Citizenship, a passport. You have to belong to the Better Business Bureau. You have to belong to this or that or whatever. To do business, you have to pay tribute or pay taxes. This is kind of the same thing. And that's why you would have people, you shouldn't pay taxes. And that they tried to nail Jesus on that because it was a big question this day. Should we be paying taxes to Babylon? Render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Give to God what belongs to God. Bigger question. What belongs to God? What belongs to Caesar? So, it simply means Nero. It was just calling him out as the personification of evil. So that's a myth, the 666. It's a myth that it's about the end of the world. It's also a myth that there was only one book of Revelation. There was a lot of these books. Well, how did it make into the Bible, Paul? Great question. It made it into the Bible under huge protest. Because this, despite it being a popular public who wanted to read it, many pastors were absolutely adamantly opposed to the teachings of this book and did not teach it. And that didn't happen until the 4th century. When Constantine, the pagan Roman emperor, converted to Christianity, legalized it, united his kingdom so that there was one emperor, now wanted to unite all the religions into one religion, and wanted to have one rule book. And he called the Council of Nicaea, as many of you know, watershed moment in Christianity. He invited 1,800 leading pastors throughout the empire to come to his seaside resort in Nicaea because he wanted to understand and nail down what is really Christianity. Of course, if you've been under hundreds of years of persecution and you get an invitation from Adolf Hitler to come to his seaside resort, you might say, I'm going to pass, which over 1,500 did. Less than 300 showed up. And they sat down with the emperor, and they sat down with his staff, and they began to hash out what was in and what was out to make this one book that we call the Bible. That was a process that took years. And in fact, it wasn't until around 365 AD that the finality of what we call the canon came to be sealed. And Revelation was fought tooth and nail by many pastors. But there was a particular one, a bishop named Athanasius, who had much power. And he wanted to make sure this book got in. And the reason he wanted to, because in his view, now the enemy, the Antichrist, the whore of Babylon, wasn't Rome. It was Christians who disagreed. Heretics. Heretics. And that was his go-to verse-quoting book. And it got voted in. It wasn't popular even after getting voted in. In fact, 500 years ago in the Reformation, Luther hated the book so much, he wanted to punt it out of the Protestant Bible. Problem is once you start doing that, what's next to get punted? So for the sake of unity, he argued against it. he put it in his Bible in an appendix and said, okay, now we move forward. But that's how it stayed in. I would submit to you that while it is fascinating, it is a fascinating book. Historically, it is awesome as a scholar to study it, read it, and understand its context and language. It has also been the single most destructive Antichrist book that's ever been written. Because of that one little thing at the end, the teachings of Jesus have been devalued, have been declawed, defanged, and completely transferred into the crap that we call Christianity today in America. A Christianity that is all about empire, all about politics, all about power, all about vengeance, and all about dishing it out and winning in the end. But I submit to you that's not the gospel. So this is my summation, 35 minutes, of the book of Revelation. Peace and grace be with you.